I'd like now to welcome to the Radio Cafe documentary photographer Carlin Tapp. He will be speaking on Monday, March 11th at 6 o'clock at the Santa Fe Art Institute, and his exhibition called The China Express will be opening at that time as well. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So what is the China Express?
Well, the China Express is a project that that I started on just recently, and it is a proposal to export coal from the United States, coal that's on federal land, to China. It involves trains running all the way from the Powder River Basin in Wyoming to proposed ports along the West Coast, first proposed port being in Washington State.
And so is this already happening?
There are three trains a day right now. Each train is made up of 150 cars. There are three trains a day running right now. Those numbers will increase to 19 trains a day.
What you did as a photographer, and also I guess you have become a sound recording guy in the process, you have basically traveled the entire length of that railroad. Is that correct?
That's correct. I left Santa Fe on the 15th of January and was on the road for 3 weeks. I started in the Powder River Basin. Powder River Basin is an interesting location because it's considered to be the energy capital of the United States. Currently, there are 135 trains of coal that leave the Powder River Basin every day to distribute that coal across the United States. What's happening now with the decrease of coal being used in the United States, the corporations are looking for new marketplaces, and China is that marketplace.
It's so ironic because, and I think it's one of the things that people don't understand very well about energy, is that if you do all this activism and decrease the use of coal, they'll just try to sell it to somebody else. It's not like it's not going to get burned unless we do really, really big activism or different kinds of policy.
I think it's an awareness thing to really understand what's going on and what's happening. One of the major issues that I started to pick up along the way was just stopping in communities, talking to people, seeing exactly what the long-term effects would be of doing all this. And it affects so many people across the United States. Each coal car, now imagine 19 to 20 trains a day, each with 150 cars. Each one of those coal cars loses, on average, 600 pounds of coal per 500 miles. The entire route is around 2,000 miles. So you can see what is lost along the rail in affecting agriculture, affecting communities. The magnitude of it is large, is incredibly large.
We're just talking dust?
We're talking the coal is soft coal, and so it dusts off. I did photographs in a vineyard, for example, along the Columbia River. And just from the trains traveling right now, the amount of coal is 4 to 6 inches deep that you can stick your fingers in. And it's in all along the way, highly combustible. They've had serious fires. People are power washing their driveways down because they're covered with coal dust. So it's a major issue.
Now, excuse the dumb question, but why don't they just cover the coal cars?
Well, that's a good question. They can't do it because the coal is combustible. And so if they cover the cars, the coal would automatically combust. It needs air. And it's being sold by the federal government to private industry at such a low price, in some cases like 95 cents a ton, resold to China for $95 a ton.
Oh my goodness.
And so the loss of a little bit of it along the way is of very little worry to the corporations that are shipping it.
So you went along this route and just talked to people, and we see on your website, and we'll give websites and everything at the end, but so many stories of loss. What were some of the, and of just sadness, what are some of the common threads among all the different people that you talked to along this very long route?
I think the common thread is you know, if we can put it in just a couple of words, is loss of way of life. And that was really spelled out to me over and over and over again. I spent quite a bit of time with a rancher in Wyoming, right in the Powder River Basin. He's lost 6,000 acres to the mining, In addition to that, his water wells have dropped on average 600 feet. And so the water goes down into the mining area, is pumped off by the mine, and so all the ranchers have lost that. So his ranch was homesteaded in 1918 by his family. And they're losing all that. They're losing their way of life. And you move further along the way. If this thing goes through, it's going to have real heavy impacts in some of the northern Cheyenne and will affect their fishing, their homelands. Comes all the way across to where the proposed port is in the Pacific Northwest up by Bellingham, Washington. That's the Lummi Reservation. They're proposing, the Army Corps of Engineers is proposing to build the site where the coal will be loaded onto ships and storage, 120-acre storage area, right on top of a 3,500-year-old village and burial site of the Lummi people.
Goodness.
So that's really the common thread over and over again. And in all the stories I've worked on in the last 10 years have had that same kind of a thread.
And there are so many different ways that that manifests. You just told the story about the rancher. Then there are also people who, I think it was Navajo people, a woman speaking with such sadness about losing lambs and sheep.
And that's a common thread too that we just don't hear about in the media today. The rancher, and I've worked with people across the country that have been affected by these different issues caused by coal, and livestock loss is a big one. The livestock gets poisoned, and or quite often they're born and calves, sheep can't breed.
And so this is just simply coal ash or coal dust flying off of trains, trains a day.
Right, in this case. In some other cases I've worked in, it's been the burning, it's been the waste materials, it's been from the mining itself. So it's all of those factors that come into play.
Now, you've devoted all this time to studying the effects of coal mining and transportation through documentary photography?
Yes.
How did you begin that project?
It started about 10 years ago, and I was a commercial photographer, and shortly after 9/11, I decided to kind of change the way I was doing my photography, try to use it in some way to raise a voice for things that were going on in our country. And I saw the decrease in the amount of media that's out there. The amount of media coverage is very limited today. And so independent photographers seem to be the ones that are trying to bring these stories to forefront the most. So I started working, I initially started working in the Four Corners area and looked at the health issues. And I was curious, what's going on here? What's causing this? And was really very fortunate. I had the opportunity to meet some wonderful people, local community members on the reservation who were really concerned. They shared stories with me, and one thing led to another, and it just kind of built from there. From there, I've worked in Oklahoma, I've worked in Tennessee, worked in Alabama. And now following this train route. And the common thread is how we use a resource, what we're doing with that resource. And the interesting thing is now we're at a point where we're literally giving that resource away to foreign countries, not knowing what the future may hold for that resource. Now, nanotechnology and using carbon, you know, probably 50 years down the road will be a brand new technology. We may not have that resource if we continue to use it in the way we're using it. So it may have very positive things that we can do with it.
Right. Oh, that's a very interesting way of thinking about it. I know people who are scientists who say the worst thing you can do with any fossil fuel is burn it.
Exactly.
Because there's so many great uses for it.
Right.
We're talking to documentary photographer Carlin Tapp. Now, one of the things that is also evident in your work is that the people who are most affected by this are the people with the least amount of power and money.
That's always the way. And so my work is really focused on that. Generally speaking, where we have a tendency to do these kinds of things in the United States are areas where people don't have much of a voice. So the key purpose of the work has been to create a voice for those people without a voice. And I'm honored to say that over the last 10 years, the work has been picked up. It's been used as major evidence in federal litigation for communities so that they had a voice.
Very interesting. So it's not just an art project.
Well, you know, it's taken a life of its own, and that's kind of what it does. Having started it and thinking that it was going to go in one direction and then finding out, I mean, it's taken me places. I've met incredible people. All of these people have become friends, you know, literally brothers and sisters, you know, across the country, and it's been very rewarding for me in that way.
You started at a certain point adding the audio component. So you're a documentary photographer, and there are these extraordinary black and white images, but we hear the voices of the people speaking, and that seems like a really important part of it to me. I mean, a picture can tell a lot of stories, but there are some stories that a picture just can't tell. You need the voice.
You know, it's a good point, because I thought, I always, of course, being a photographer, my philosophy is a picture tells a thousand words. But what I started to think about was I heard these stories. I would go in and meet people, and they would tell me in their own words what was going on. And so I was a neophyte with audio, still am, I consider myself, but I started to record, and not in an interview sense, but just in the sense of tell me your story. And then I started to add those stories to the photographs, and it seemed to really have much more meaning, because you were maybe looking through my eyes at the images, but you were hearing the story in their words.
Exactly. And it's interesting, because I was listening to a lot of them, and there was one guy whose life had been really devastated by this coal dust. And he said, I'm not an environmentalist. And I thought, it brings up such an interesting thing, because, I mean, everybody is or should be an environmentalist who's affected by this kind of pollution and really uncaring of human and other life. And yet, they say things like that, and it really becomes about how do I identify, what people do I identify with, as opposed to what issues do I identify with.
Right. Right, and that's what I find out more often than not. These are just people who, like you and I, want to live their life in the way they've always lived their life. They have the right to do that. That's the big one for us here in the United States, an American right. And, you know, they know when that's taken away from them. And so they'll quite often make it very clear, I'm not an environmentalist, I'm not an activist, I'm a community member.
And yet they will talk about environmental injustice, which is really what this looks like.
Absolutely. And that is what it is all about. Absolutely.
We're talking to documentary photographer Carlin Tapp. Not only environmental injustice, but also, and we see this everywhere, and it just kills me that it's still going on year after year, century after century, but environmental racism. Indian people, black people, people who, as you say, don't have a voice and have been marginalized for so long.
You know, it's really true, and that's what I see again, over and over again. I was shortly after the big Kingston fly ash spill, the biggest thing and biggest environmental disaster of its kind in the history of our country that really got underplayed in 2008. And they didn't know what to do with this 40 years worth of coal ash, which is actually the most toxic stuff because that's where the heavy metals are. And I had worked down in Kingston quite a bit, and they finally got a location where they could deposit this. And I followed the rail there, 300 miles south, and they deposited it in the poorest black community, Uniontown, where the average household income is less than $8,000, unemployment rate over 80%. And the people had no voice at all, and they literally dumped it in their front yard.
And what happened?
It's still in their front yard.
How has it affected them?
It's I think that looking at it, they have major issues with water runoff off high arsenic levels, polluted water wells, and you know, it only time will tell. You know, that's just happened a couple of years ago. You go down to Bokoshi, Oklahoma, where I've worked quite a bit, and the people down there were subjected to a lot of exposure to coal ash. And what happened is 10 years later, a town of 500 people, 150 have died of cancer.
Oh, my goodness.
I go into a sixth grade classroom, and there's 17 students in a sixth grade classroom, nine of which are sitting on inhalers because they have asthma caused by the coal ash that's in the air. So those are the effects. Those are the things that happen, you know, in these communities that kind of go without a voice.
So what, in your view, needs to be done?
I think awareness. I think that all of us every single person in the United States, and I do feel this very strongly, want things to be right. But I don't think they know. And I think that one of the main purposes of the work that we do is to draw that awareness, educational awareness. I'm still a firm believer that if people are given the opportunity to view, see, and understand a situation, then they can make an educated decision on what should be done. If you don't know something's happening, you can't. I can't get upset at that person.
Right. And so your exhibition is opening on Monday, the 11th of March at 6 o'clock at the Santa Fe Art Institute. You'll be giving a lecture and showing some of your work, and maybe we'll be listening to some of the audio as well?
Correct, yes.
And that's at the Santa Fe Art Institute at 6, and then the opening is happening at the same time. And then it'll be open 9 to 5, Monday through Friday, through the 5th of April. So we've got about 3 weeks to see it at the Santa Fe Art Institute, and it's free admission. People can go whenever they want, and they can also go to SFAI, Santa Fe Art Institute, .org. And then you have a website, carlantapp.com, and that's spelled carlantapp.com. And you've really collected a lot of your work that we can see online.
Yeah, there, and then the foundation website is really a great place to go to, because that has all the recorded stories there, and that is questionofpower.org.
Questionofpower.org. Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. What's next on your world of projects?
Well, actually, you know, the China Express story is just in its infancy, and I've just kind of like touched the surface of it. And so I've been asked to come back to the Pacific Northwest to work with the Lummi, and I'll be working with them in the next few months.
Do you feel that the voice of Native Americans, in terms of all of these environmental and energy issues and so on, is getting stronger, is getting to be a little more heard over the years?
Absolutely. I really do. I just, you know, things have changed a lot. They've changed, in some places they've changed a lot, in some places they haven't. But I do think that people standing up and wanting to have and drawing a line in the sand and saying, this is not right, you know, is what's really starting to evolve. And it's a good thing. It's a really good thing.
Carlin Tapp is a documentary photographer. Once again, carlantapp.com and questionofpower.org. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
And we'll see you Monday at the Santa Fe Art Institute.
Great. Thank you.
I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Don Edwards. He's a historian, author, and musicologist specializing in cowboy music. He's been called America's cowboy balladeer. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you. It's great to be with you.
And we're also joined here in the cafe by Tom Leach, who is curator of the press at the Palace of the Governors, and Kate Nelson with the New Mexico History Museum. Now, Don Edwards will be here singing and doing his cowboy ballads and much more on Sunday, the 10th of March at 2 o'clock at the New Mexico History Museum Auditorium. And there is a show opening, which is called Cowboys Real and Imagined, that opens on the 14th of April. Let's talk for a moment before we get to Don. What's that show about, this cowboy show at the New Mexico History Museum?
This is probably the biggest show that we've put on, an original show, since the opening of the museum in 2009, and we had Fashioning New Mexico. Cowboys Real and Imagined begins with the Spanish vaquero tradition in the late 1500s and carries the visitor up through modern day cowboys. And along the way, we're going on trail rides, we're getting to know some of the outlaw cowboys, we're becoming acquainted with how Teddy Roosevelt, Owen Wister, Frederick Remington, and Charles Russell turned cowboys from a sort of disgraced profession into the American hero. And we talk about cowboy music, cowboy movies, cowboy poets, and we end the whole exhibit with a question of, in a volatile global market, in a time of climate change, can cowboys survive?
What is the role of the press at the Palace of the Governors?
Well, I would have to go back almost 10 years shortly after I started here at the museum, and I learned the story of Jack Thorpe and his book, Songs of the Cowboys. It was the I think, quintessential cowboy songbook. It was certainly the first, and it was printed in Estancia, New Mexico in 1908, and as it turns out, it was printed on the press that is sort of featured at the Palace Press. And so that sort of became something that I just felt like had to be told, and told often and well. And so we started printing a new edition of Songs of the Cowboys, and really trying to give it the honored place in history and book history that it deserves.
Don Edwards, you are well known across the country for the music that you perform. How did you get into cowboy music?
Well, actually, I've loved it since I can remember. I mean, it's just something I always had to listen to all my entire life. I guess I got started because most of the course, naturally, the 19th century cowboy was gone by the time I got around here, you know. And so I really got it from listening to phonograph records and things like that. My dad had a huge record collection, and I found a couple of cowboy records, one by Bill Bender and the other one by Carl Sandburg. And I played and played and played and played these records, and they were the first two or three songs I ever, one was Goodbye Old Paint, and the other one was Whoopie Tie I.O. Get Along Little Dogies. And
right.
I just loved it, and it was real easy to play. You see, when I was teaching myself how to play, it was just little three-chord songs, you know. And I just wore out those records amongst hundreds of records my dad had. He loved every genre of music there was at the time, and they're all on 78 records, and I've still got them, actually. But that was my introduction to cowboy music, because there was no stars of cowboy music like there was in Western music, like Gene Autry and Roy Rogers and Tex Ritter and Rex Allen, things like that, you know. So it was quite popular, the cowboy music, but there was no particular artist that did them. Tex Ritter was probably the closest, that was a very well-known artist that stayed the closest to the cowboy music than any of the rest of them.
I would think that, I mean, you've been collecting these songs, and I imagine that probably a lot of them would have been lost if people didn't collect them, if people like you didn't collect them and get them from perhaps old-timers who still remember them. But some of these songs were recorded, some of those recordings get lost, and some of them weren't even recorded in the first place. So what has this process been like for you all these years?
It's something I've always loved to do. I love the stories as much as I love the songs and the history of them. And I'm talking when I was just a little kid. I just love those stories that they told about them. Kind of like the theme there you're carrying on is the, you know, real and imagined, you know. I mean, that's the West I lived in, both real and imagined, you know. I mean, I knew the difference between the real cowboy and the so-called professional singing cowboy, you know.
Right,
there was
right.
A big difference between the two of them. But the music and the stories of those old songs were just so intriguing to me that I looked at it. I always have. I guess when I started, I've always been a folk singer, because cowboy music was always a part of their repertoire. You know, every folk singer knew cowboy songs, not commercial ones, but the old-time ones. And
right.
So that kind of kept that alive, through the 60s. But I've always loved it, and then the thing I turned toward that because I had no desire, really, to be a big star. I mean, that sounds weird, you know, because a lot of people say, oh, I want to sell a million records. I couldn't have cared less, you know. And I just wanted to play that music until I was told by other people what I was doing. I was just doing it out of the pure love of it, you know. But it was something that was disappearing. And so I said, gosh, you know, that if your stories go away and if your songs go away, this is the difference between us as being here for, what, I don't know, 300 years maybe now, and the native people who were here for 12,000 years. And that's because they handed down their stories and their songs and part of their culture. And even in Appalachia today, there's still little places, little small communities and things that still have songs that have never been written down. These little kids are learning songs that have never been written down on a piece of paper. And I just took that over into the cowboy music, you know, and just I just do what I do, you know, and I love doing it, and I'm glad there's people out there that like it as well, you know, because it is a part of our history.
So let's talk more about the real and imagined for a moment. I mean, the cowboy music that you sing and that you collect, I imagine some of it is what you might call like 19th century authentic cowboy music, and some of it is like a romanticizing of the cowboy mythology.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly right. And the songs have been worked and reworked, and, you know, and people take verses of them and stick them in another song. And it's just an old tradition, you know, that they've just been passed around. And the more written Western songs were, you know, I sing a lot of those too as well. And but those are the ones that most people remember. They don't remember the old ones because most of those old cowboy songs were not documented until later. If it wasn't for people like Jack Thorpe, like Tom was just saying about Jack Thorpe, if it wasn't for him, nobody would probably have heard about it. But by passing it around from one cow camp to another, these songs sort of got, they grew. In other words, like Thorpe was saying, there was no place where a cowboy, a working cowboy, would know a song all the way through. And so they just would pick up a verse here, and the collector would pick up a verse there in different places, and they just sort of compile them. And so John Lomax, basically 2 years after Thorpe came along, he put out a very popular book, The Cowboy Songs and Frontier Ballads. And when he did that, that brought around the popularity, like radio, early days of radio. It was Lomax's book they were using because he took the liberties to kind of dress them for the, to make them palatable to the general audience, you know, the general public. But the old cowboy songs that Thorpe collected, he collected them just like he heard them.
And he would talk about how fast he had to work to write down what he heard maybe the next day or whenever he could get to pen and paper. And in particular, Tom, there's a story about trying to document some African-American cowboys.
Yeah, that was the start of the whole story. Jack's job was, he was a working cowboy, and he was rounding up strays, and one night wandered into a camp of black cowboys down near Roswell, and they were singing songs, and there was one of the songs called Dodgin' Joe, and he wrote down two verses of it, and that's all he got. But by the time he woke up the next morning, he had decided that this was important, that somebody had to write these songs down, and he sent a letter to his boss and said, "I quit," and he spent the next 2 years riding 2,000 miles all over the West, going into cow camps, collecting these songs.
Amazing.
Doesn't that sound like the life?
Yeah, and these are the songs that we learned in sixth grade music class back in public school.
Well, that's exactly it.
That's right. And what you were saying, Tom, was about the black cowboys that were singing in that cow camp. I think, personally, Thorpe had heard a lot of cowboy songs, you know, in various times in his life and never thought much of it. But when he heard that camp, Addison Jones's cow camp, and those guys were all black, but it was that what they were singing, there was no genre of the blues, you know what I mean, back then. But that's what Thorpe was hearing. He was hearing the interpretation of those songs. And to back that up, a man by the name of Will C. Barnes, who has written several books, he was a historian, he was a author, he was a soldier, but he took the time to write it down in a journal. And most of the old cowboys couldn't have cared less. They were out there for having a good time, and they, you know, that was the least important thing on their books, you know. But what Will Barnes did was he observed that when he went to these cow towns, he said he listened to professional musicians. And this was right after the Civil War. And a lot of these ex-slaves and things like that, and even non-slaves, went west. And there was a lot of them said, "I want to be a cowboy, just like anybody else." So this is the life they took, but the music that they brought with them, and it mixed that music up. And Will Barnes said that of all the singers that he'd heard on the trail were these professional musicianers, he called them. He said they were songsters and musicianers. And he said they sang, they fixed up these cowboy ballads to make them more accessible to other people as well. The best of these professional musicians were black. And he said they played guitars, violins, banjos, and they were the ones that saved this cowboy music on the range, is what he said. He quoted that.
For the exhibit, Cowboys Real and Imagined, we'll have a lot of cowboy music and oral histories and poetry throughout it. Jack Leffler, a wonderful man and a great oral historian, has been gathering renewed performances of some of these classic songs. He's pulled on some of the Lomax recordings and then his own bank of audio that he's taken across New Mexico all these years.
Yes, he was telling me some about that, too. I was very interested in hearing about that. That's just wonderful. I just think it's wonderful what y'all are doing. I mean, it's just where we've kind of forgot our history, you know?
I think one of the things that's so interesting about it, too, is that there's so many different musical strains that go into this kind of cowboy music. I mean, you were talking about African-American music and the blues, and then I was listening to your song Cattle Call, and there's just bona fide yodeling in that.
Oh, yeah. That was influence of those touring, like the Tyrolean yodelers, you know, from Switzerland. You know, they came here in the 1850s. A lot of that was learned from them. I mean, I probably would pick up people like Jimmy Rogers that had probably heard some of that, you know. So that is a part of the cowboy music, but the old-timers always said it wasn't yodeling, it was howling and humming. That's what how they thought of it as, you know. It said, we're just singing to cows till we got horse, you know.
Well, is there such a thing as contemporary cowboy music, or is it mostly...
Oh, yeah. No, there is. Today, yeah, there's a lot of great songwriters out there that, to this day, like Mike Fleming in California, Dave Stamian in California, Andy Hedges from out in Lubbock, Texas.
But, I mean, with great respect, are these people real cowboys?
Yeah. They're doing their story. And I think it's very commendable. Brent Hill from Utah, he's doing the same thing. And I say they're young. They're a lot younger than I am. I mean, they're in their 30s, you know, things like that. But I am very pleased to know that there's people carrying it on and writing new material because they have to write of their lifetime. I mean, of right now. You know, whereas most of my music is interpreted. I do write some, but it sounds sort of like the old stuff. But right. A lot of these newer artists that are coming out now are doing a great job. They're great writers and great players. I think it's wonderful. But there's only one thing that I stress so much, but a lot of times it falls on deaf ears, is don't forget the old stuff. You know, don't throw that away for the new. I mean, you've got to write new material because you've got to tell your story now, you know, to keep that alive. But you've also got to carry on the other stories as well and the songs. But very few people, that's where it comes into being that I'm 74 years old and I've been at this 52, 53 years. And there are very few people coming on that know the old stuff. Like you get people like Ian Tyson, Ramblin' Jack Elliott, people like that has a huge repertoire of cowboy songs. I try to explain it to the younger group to that, you know, you've got to write your story and bring it forward to now, but don't forget the old stuff. You know, it doesn't hurt to do, you know, goodbye old paint in your set, you know, and
right,
just tell them this is old traditional song. And that's what we did. I mean, the older guys, we always did those old songs because if it wasn't for them, we wouldn't be here.
Don Edwards is a historian, author, and musicologist. His specialty is cowboy music. He's called America's Cowboy Balladeer, and he will be here in Santa Fe this Sunday, the 10th of March at 2 in the afternoon at the New Mexico History Museum Auditorium. And Tom Leach has been with us. He's the curator of the press at the Palace of the Governors, and Kate Nelson from the New Mexico History Museum. The exhibition that opens on April 14th is called Cowboys Real and Imagined. Thank you, everybody, for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for having us.
If you want to reserve a ticket for Sunday's event, where should people call?
982-9543, or you can log on to newmexicocreates.org.
newmexicocreates.org, and we're going to go out with a cowboy ballad.
Little Joe the Wrangler will wrangle nevermore. His days with the Ramuda, they are o'er. 'Twas a year ago last April when he rode into our camp. A little Texas stray and all alone. Was late in the evening when he rode up to the herd on a little old brown pony he called Chaw. With broken shoes and overalls, a tougher looking kid you never in your life had ever saw. His saddle was a southern cack built many years ago, an OK spur on one foot idly hung. With his hot roll in a cotton sack loosely tied behind, and a canteen from his saddle horn was slung. He said he had to leave his home, his pa had married twice, and his new ma whipped him every day or two. So he saddled up old Chaw one night and he lit a shut this way. Now he's trying hard to paddle his own canoe. He said if we would give him work, he'd do the best he could, though he didn't know straight up about a cow. So the boss, he cut him out a mount and he kindly put him on, for he sort of liked the little kid somehow. Well, he learned to jingle horses and to know them one and all, and to get them in by daybreak if he could, and to follow the chuck wagon and to always hitch the team, and to help the cocinero rustle wood. We'd driven to Red River, the weather being fine, we were camped out on the south side in a bend. When a norther commenced to blowin', we doubled up our guard, for it took all hands to hold the cattle in. Now little Joe the wrangler was called out with the rest, and though the kid had scarcely reached the herd, when the cattle they stampeded like a hailstorm long they fled, and we were all a-ridin' for the lead. Amidst the streaks of lightning there was one horse up ahead, trying to stop the leaders in their speed. Was little Joe the wrangler with a slicker o'er his head? He was riding old Blue Rocket in the lead. Now we finally got a milling and kinda quieted down, and the extra guard back to the wagon road. But there was one a-missing, and we knew it at a glance, was our little Texas stray, poor Wrangler Joe. Next morning, just at daybreak, we found where Rocket fell, down in a washout 20 feet below. And beneath his horse, mashed to a pulp, his spur had rung the knell for our little Texas stray, poor Wrangler Joe. Now little Joe the wrangler, he'll wrangle nevermore, and his days with the Ramuda, they are o'er. 'Twas a year ago last April when he rode into our camp, just a little Texas stray and nothing more.
I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Nicole Phelps. She's director of the new play In the Time of the Butterflies. It's a play by Caridad Switch, which opens on the 8th of March and runs for several weekends. It's a production of Teatro Paraguas. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me, Mary Charlotte.
And we're also joined by actors Cristina Vigil and Roxanne Tapia. And it's great to have you all here. Mm-hmm. Now, this is a play about a terrible time in the history of the Dominican Republic, and it's about these sisters called the Mirabal Sisters. Now, this is based on a true story. Who were these sisters?
So the Mirabal Sisters were part of a family. They were well-educated, upper-middle-class women. And Trujillo, Rafael Trujillo, was dictator from 1930 to 1961. So pretty much the entire lives of the sisters. And the sisters began to fight against Rafael Trujillo in an underground revolution that was happening because people were just sick and tired of the treatment. People were being arrested every day for reasons that just weren't important. Offending the dictator.
And so this was made into not only a play, but a novel by Julia Alvarez. Mm.
Exactly, yes. And Caridad wrote the play based on the novel by Julia Alvarez, yes.
So let's talk a little bit about how the play is structured. It moves around in time.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Caridad writes in a way that she plays with reality. She doesn't go, it's not a kitchen sink play. Time and places are bent for her, so it can really kind of go in and out and morph. So it's Dede, who is the sister who did survive, who was not assassinated. She's kind of having it's like a memory play. She's imagining all of these times through an interview that she's having with a writer who was born in the United States, but who comes from Dominican parents who fled the country.
Right, okay. Now, let's talk about the characters of the sisters. Roxanne and Christina, you play two of these three sisters. Tell us a little bit about their characters.
Well, I play Maria Teresa, who is the youngest. She's the baby of the group, and she's kind of the comedic relief of the four.
Right.
She's very into fashion and celebrities and all the glamour and you know, while all of the sisters are into this very serious political thing, she's talking about, you know, Zsa Zsa Gabor and silly things like that. And she eventually does join the movement, but she's the epitome of girliness.
Right. And yeah. I think that's one of the things that makes this play so charming is that it's not just a kind of hit you over the head with the evil of the dictatorship mm-hmm. thing. It's real people, real sisters, families, loves, arguments within the family, that kind of thing.
That was actually what was both challenging and very interesting about the dialogue is she writes it in a very familiar way, in a very family way, like where you don't let your siblings like finish their sentences or you don't wait for them to stop talking. You talk over them. Like, and she has a very nice way of writing the dialogue that way.
Very interesting. Now tell us about your character, Roxanne.
So my character is Dede in the past. So I'm actually the fourth sister, the one that doesn't die in the accident.
Yes, the part which we're not going to talk about yet.
It's not assassinated, let's say. So my character is more concerned with family and her husband and her children than sort of getting involved in the movement until it's kind of thrust upon her by what happens to her sisters.
Right, exactly. Now, I think one of the things that's so interesting about this play for an audience member is it kind of makes you go through the thought experiment of what you would do under those circumstances. What would you do under a military dictatorship where you either join to try to blend, you know, join the bad guy, or you resist because that's the right thing to do, or you just pretend nothing's happening and put your head in the sand, and all of those positions are represented
yes,
in this play.
Exactly.
Did you come up with the idea of doing this play to coincide with International Women's Day?
No, that was not the plan originally. We were actually looking to do this in the fall of 2012. But because of circumstances and dates and things kind of kept being pushed forward. And then when we finally did decide on the dates, it was one of those happy accidents that occurred that was like, oh, good, this is perfect for... it was perfect timing.
And especially since we've been dealing with so much of this question of violence against women in the world, mm-hmm. whether it be in the Congo or in India or here, or women being raped in the military. I mean, it's everywhere, and everywhere it's a tool of either direct war or kind of war on women.
Exactly. And I think that one of the things that attracted me when I read this play and really started learning about who these women were was the fact that they each sort of found their power, especially in the play. They're discovering their power, and in a place and time where it could have been very easy to just sit back and say, I can't do anything, I'm powerless. these women said, rose up and said, no, we're going to change no matter what the price.
And so in real life, the fourth sister, played by Roxanne, was the memory of not only this family, but really of a whole period in history.
Exactly. And she's the storyteller for generations and generations. Thousands of people come every year to the Mirabal Museum, learning and relearning, educating themselves about what happened, and hopefully never letting anything like this happen again.
So we're talking about the play In the Time of the Butterflies, and it opens this Friday, the 8th of March. Now, tell us a little bit about all of your involvement in Teatro Paraguas, because we've been covering them on this show for many years, and it's a very interesting company.
I've been involved with Teatro Paraguas since I was really young. I think the first play I did maybe was when I was 16, maybe? And it was like a little scary stories for Halloween or something like that. And it was all in Spanish, and Spanish is not my first language. And since then, you know, every time some other production comes up, Argos lets me know, he emails me, and they're just a great company. Argos always takes care of his actors and his crew, and they're a pleasure to work with, always.
And they always do plays and readings that are either Spanish or Latin American mm-hmm. or Hispanic themes of various kinds.
Yes.
Sometimes bilingual, mostly in English though, isn't it?
It's true, yes. Most of the shows are in English with mm-hmm. with a little bit of Spanish sometimes.
Mm-hmm. How did you get involved? Are you also, Nicole, an actor?
I am an actor. I moved here in 2010 and I just started kind of getting involved with various theater projects around town, and I met Argos. I've done several Robert Benjamin's shows. We did a few readings there. And again, I just was really attracted to Teatro Paraguas because it's so community-based. They really believe in letting people express themselves and spread their wings in a way that is so liberating and freeing as an actor, as a director. It's been really exciting to be part of this theater group.
And Roxanne?
I auditioned for the Teatro Paraguas. They had an open call for auditions, and I came down to see what it was about. And that's when I met Argos and found out that he was at the College of Santa Fe, where I went to school and studied theater and stuff. We weren't there at the same time, but he is there now. And I got involved just doing various things like working, selling tickets when they do shows and handing out programs, you know, house management kind of things. And I signed on to direct a show, but then it kind of fell through. We didn't get enough cast members. So that was my first experience with him. And he was just real supportive and, you know, kept coming back with other opportunities. And this was one of them. And it's been great working with Nicole and working with Teatro. I'm really looking forward to doing more in the future.
I guess that must be hard in a town this small, is getting the right cast for mm-hmm. any given play that you want.
Definitely.
Especially with all of the theaters doing something all at the same time. So
yeah.
Your acting pool is very small.
Right. Now, are you getting, or do you think you'll be getting students from the New Mexico School for the Arts and some of those programs? Are they going to graduate or even during their school years come into the...
We've had a couple who started in teatro. There were three students that I started working with who now go to NMSA and are graduating this year. But so, yeah, they got their start at Teatro, and now they're at NMSA.
It'll be so, I mean, the whole NMSA, not to get on a whole new subject, but it'll be interesting to see what happens if people stay in New Mexico mm-hmm. having graduated from there.
Yeah.
We also have students from the high school running, like, the sound and light boards for
us. Yes.
So we really get the community involved in the theater.
So the play is called In the Time of the Butterflies. It's a new play by Caridad Switch, and it opens this Friday, the 8th of March, and it runs through the 24th of March, so it's Fridays and Saturdays at 7:30 in the evening and Sundays at 2 in the afternoon, and it's at the Teatro Paraguas Studio and Theater, which is at 3205 Calle Marie here in Santa Fe, and that is kind of on that road up behind Home Depot. And I want to thank you all very much for being here. Nicole Phelps, director, Cristina Vigil, actor, and Roxanne Tapia in The Time of the Butterflies. Thanks for being on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. My email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org, and we're on Twitter at radiocafemc. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz. Mataron al chivo en la carretera. Mataron al chivo en la carretera. Déjenmelo ver, déjenmelo ver, déjenmelo ver. Mataron al chivo y no me lo dejaron ver. El pueblo celebra con mucho entusiasmo la fiesta del chivo. El 30 de mayo vamos a reír, vamos a bailar, vamos.